In April 2023, the United States was forced to evacuate our embassy in Khartoum, Sudan, as civil conflict consumed the nation. In this three-part series, you'll hear from a range of DSS personnel involved in the operation, giving you a first-hand look at how we enabled diplomats and American citizens to withdraw safely. Joining us now remotely is Jacob Carrasco, who can tell us more about Khartoum. Thank you for being here, Jacob.
Happy to be present.
So, Jacob, you were another one of the assistant regional security officers in Khartoum, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So tell me a little bit about what the evacuation was like for you.
It started pretty much like any other day in Khartoum. It was on a weekend. I woke up probably around 10 o'clock. One of the other assistant regional security officers, Kelly Doffing, had gone to my house and rung the doorbell a number of times.
Yeah, we spoke to Kelly earlier. This is now, you're talking about Saturday the 15th, the day the whole city
yes.
kind of went into lockdown?
I head downstairs and open my door, and there's Kelly smiling, and all of a sudden I hear gunshots and mortars whistles ringing in the background.
Wow.
She says, Ryan wants you downstairs with your pistol and your armor, and we are meeting upstairs in 15 minutes. And then she scuttled off.
We heard a lot about the evacuation steps. Can you tell me a little bit more about, there was a certain motorcade. You were moving from the villas to another property, trying to consolidate some people on, I think, Monday the 17th?
Yes. So as conditions started to grow worse out in the city, one of our properties, Charlie 9, was closer towards the Sudanese armed forces and headquarters, as well as the presidential compound. As that was the site of most of the fighting, a lot of the artillery shells and the mortars that they were putting down range that way were kind of finding their way closer towards Charlie 9.
Okay.
So we decided that because it was close, because we were going to get a ceasefire or at least a lull in the fighting for a minute, we would make this move. This being Ramadan, most people were fasting during the day. So we did our moves kind of like in the middle of the day where all the heat would bear down on these people. And because there's no food or water in their system, many of them are kind of slow on the trigger. So we kind of chose the best time, knew that the route was clear, and we were going to make this move. So we took four cars. In a motorcade and went to this property.
Okay, so how long was this trip supposed to be from where you were at the villas to Charlie 9?
The trip is probably less than 5 minutes.
And this is an area you knew well, right?
Yes, so I had gone grocery shopping in this area, often go over to the property for, hangouts and events, and they have a nice pool there.
Right, so this is your kind of home turf now suddenly turned into a war zone.
Yes. I mean, the second that drop arm went open and the gate opened, it was almost surreal. It looked like an average day in Khartoum. People were walking around, sitting outside, talking, chatting to one another. Occasionally you would see a truck with the Sudanese armed forces just loaded with ammunition flying by, but everything else looked relatively normal, which didn't mesh well with the bullets impacting the side of our houses and the mortars coming over the wall.
So you mentioned that there was a lot of gunfire and mortars and things going off, but people's houses were actually being hit. Is that right?
Yeah. These were 50 caliber rounds, kind of, they call it the Dishka. A lot of people, kind of started collecting bullets off the floor, almost making like jelly bean jars.
So they were coming through the walls, through the windows. Were we being shot at, or this was kind of incidental fire?
So it was twofold. One side of the conflict had an air force and the other side didn't.
Okay.
So whenever the planes would come in, they would follow the Nile. And we actually lived on Nile Street. So you get an excited gunner going after a MiG just boom, 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 boom.
Wow. Yeah, so rounds going everywhere.
Yeah, so those rounds have to impact somewhere, and one of them was my bedroom where I found this.
Excellent.
Wow. So these were coming through the windows and through the walls, or through the, how did this come to your bedroom?
At the back of the property, there's basically a fence that kind of faces the Nile. Rounds were starting to come basically over the fence and fall kind of with an arc, hitting the back wall, hitting the windows. And some people's houses weren't as impacted. Some people basically absorbed all the rounds.
Wow.
I got a lot of love and attention during this conflict, for my house.
Okay. So this is happening as the conflict begins for a couple of days, and now you're out in a motorcade trying to pick people up from another location. Because despite all this happening, your compound is still the safest place.
Yes. So because of where the artillery rounds were falling, and because of the small size of the compounds that a lot of these people were living at, also we were getting a lot of reports of stray elements of this militia going in and breaking into embassies and compounds, taking diplomats hostage, assaulting them, causing injury. And we just felt that a compound of 41 people was better than a compound of only 7 by itself.
So you set forth with a 4-car motorcade. Which car were you in?
I was in the rear vehicle. I had been tasked with getting in touch with the local guards to make sure that the drop arms were open, and everybody was ready to go once we got there. It also allowed me to operate the radio to put out calls. And we also had a speaker, which had we run across any element or checkpoint that didn't immediately open fire, we would be able to talk to them, kind because we couldn't roll down the windows,
sure,
which is a big, big deal for checkpoints. If you're just going to roll through a checkpoint, they're not going to respond too well.
So you got, how far in the drive to the other property did you get?
So for the Charlie 9 operation, we were actually able to successfully recover everybody. We got 7 people, got them in the car, and got them back to the compound.
Okay.
We then immediately set up again to go to Charlie 7, where a section head was actually living by himself in a very bad neighborhood. We had heard he had gotten some pretty gnarly neighbors, rowdy individuals, and we wanted to move him out of that area as fast as we could.
Yeah.
So again, we take those 4 cars, we line them up, gate opens, we're out. And probably we drove probably 5 or 6 minutes, and right about 300 meters out, we make that final turn. And I just see the motorcade in front of me just speed up. I mean, really pick up. We go from probably 20, 30 kilometers an hour to well over 80 in seconds.
Yeah.
So we're trying to keep up at the back of the convoy. I say, oh, well, they must have seen something, or maybe they already got him and we're just starting to move now as units.
So you weren't in radio contact with the other cars, exactly.
I was in radio contact with the other cars, but the front car didn't put anything out over the radio.
Got it. So they were reacting to something.
Yes. I think whatever it was got them to the point where they needed to move.
Yeah.
And that's all they were thinking about. So, I mean, dust is kicking up. I'm not seeing anything. I just see the car in front of me go from, you know, here and then blowing down.
Yeah. They're going less than 20 miles per hour and suddenly they're going 50. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was happening in your vehicle?
In my vehicle, I'm kind of reaching out over the radio, trying to figure out what's going on. All of a sudden I hear just the loud thud. Almost like a big bug hit the windshield, at which point I started seeing those, the spider webs on the windshield start popping up. At which point I knew what was going on, and I just put out of the radio, drive through, drive through, drive through. And we immediately haul it.
So to be clear, this is you taking weapons fire.
Yes. So we'd started to get AK-47 rounds impacting the car. It's right about at this point when I see somebody walk out in basic Sudanese attire and flip-flops and fire from the waist an AK-47 directly at our car.
Wow. What's going through your mind at this point?
At this point, it's just get through the ambush. If somebody sets up a kill zone, you want to get through that kill zone as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
While you can back out of an ambush, I didn't know what was directly behind us. Knowing that they controlled this entire neighborhood, it seemed the car in front determined that there was a way out.
Yeah.
So we continued through, blew through the ambush as quickly as possible. This individual just fires as many shots as he can. We're continuing down, and then to my right, I look out the right window and see basically a military truck. And immediately behind that, I just see the muzzle of an AK-47. And I make eye contact with the gunman, and he just pulls the trigger, and it's boom, 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 boom.
Wow. So at some point, the vehicle holds together, but at some point, the engine fails or some other component.
Yeah, so luckily we made it through the kill zone. We thought we were home free. The head, the convoy calls back and says, "Hey, Jacob, you still with us?" And I say, I'm still with you. And we hook a right turn kind of by where I used to go and buy groceries.
Right.
We make it past the grocery store, hook a right again, and then are kind of next to a cemetery, and our vehicle just dies, comes to a halt. Kind of a bad omen.
Yeah, no kidding. So you're now in need of an evac of some kind.
We're sitting there. I look at my driver and I say, "Well, guys, I think we might have to walk back on this one. Let me put out a call." In an excited state, I immediately just go, "We're dead, we're dead, we're dead." Which the correct call is, our vehicle is down.
Right.
It's
right.
It's a pretty harrowing call to make to the ACC, just to hear over the radio, "We're dead, we're dead."
Right. Excellent. So at some point you do get an assist, right?
Yes. So, as I'm putting out over the radio, "We're dead, we're dead, we're dead. We need somebody to push out." The vehicles I see just hauling down the street, and the last one, right before it hits the turn the other two took, does a wide loop and comes back to us. And I said, "Oh, thank goodness they heard us."
You are well clear of the attack site. What do you see around you? You see the cemetery.
It looks like a normal day in Sudan. I see people walking around, you know. Wow. Women going to the grocery store, men just lounging out front. Everybody kind of looks at us because we're the odd vehicle that's just broken down in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
One of the security guys just comes out and he's like, "Hey, you guys doing okay?" And I was like, "Yeah, I think I'm good."
So one of the guys from the other car actually got out of his vehicle?
Yeah. Okay. He said he had felt safe at that point.
Okay.
Because he sees everything around. There's no feedback of immediate danger.
Okay.
I crack open my door and he's like, "I told them to put it into neutral, so maybe we could push this thing out."
Okay.
He said, "No, yeah, that's probably a good idea."
Okay.
And I said, "All right."
What, their car had also taken fire or?
Yeah. So, all of the cars took well over 20 rounds apiece.
Wow.
I'd say hundreds of rounds went into this whole convoy.
Yeah.
Their tires had been blown out. The front of their car had been peppered. Their windshield is spider webs just like ours.
Wow.
From light rounds. It's still functioning. So they come right behind us. We flip the car in neutral.
How far did you have to go?
It was probably 2 or 3 kilometers. It was a long time. It was a long push out. And it was just roll, slow roll of the thump, the thump, the thump.
Wow. This does remind me of some of the things that we cover in training. How well do you feel like the training prepared you for this?
You know, that attack scenario felt just like Atlas. One of the scenarios you do is you come up and they have an ambush set up for you. And the second somebody pulls out a gun, you see paintballs hit the windshield and you just go.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we did. Radio calls were the same. rolling through the same. And what's weird is AK-47 rounds hitting that windshield sounds a lot like a paintball.
Wow.
If anyone has questions, if the armor works, it does. I can guarantee it.
Your colleagues push your dead vehicle all the way back to the villas. Mm-hmm. What happens to you next then? You jump out of the car and you're getting medical treatment, or what's happening to you?
As we're moving closer to the tea house, I hear one of the other ARSOs shouting, like, Jacob, I need you here right now, right now. I run over and she basically grabs the front of my plates, flips me around, throws the ambassador on my back and says, take him to his meeting.
So when you said they put the ambassador on your back, you don't mean that you were carrying the ambassador?
No, no. One of our protective techniques is to keep plates in front of a protectee.
Plates being your body armor, the hard body armor.
So you want basically that body armor to also serve as their body armor in case of round impacts.
Yeah.
So basically what she did is the ambassador, we had trained him before, just grabbed my belt loop instinctively, grabbed the top of my plates, and we moved right into this car. I immediately closed the door, and then we were off. The meeting was inside the compound, but due to the amount of rounds that were coming from the sky, we did most of our movements in armored cars.
Wow, that's incredible. So you get to the meeting. When does the adrenaline dump? Like when do you kind of come down eventually?
So I am basically sitting in this room and the ambassador's taking his meeting and other security who was there came and checked on me. And one of the things I remember from training was you could be so hyped up on adrenaline that you don't know if a round hits you. So I asked, can you do a quick rake of me? Just to make sure that there isn't, you know, a round somewhere.
Which is a physical rake with your fingers,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
Where they actually physically rake you top to bottom to make sure that nothing impacted.
Because a finger would catch in a bullet hole.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was good. He's like, all right, take off your plates. We're going to get to know each other real well.
Yeah.
And he did the rake and everything. And he said, nope, you're fine. And at that moment, I think the real decompress started.
So after this happened, you had another 5 days you had to work to get people put together and get the evacuation prepped. What was your emotional state after that?
One thing I would say is if you ever find yourself in a situation like this, is try to get as much sleep as possible. Without that sleep, those rounds and those impacts and those mortars, they start to take a little bit more of a mental toll as time continues. By the end of it, I was very physically and mentally tired.
I think at the end or toward the end, you're beating yourself up for things and how things might have gone better or different. There was something that somebody said to you that kind of encouraged you. Is that right?
Yeah. When I came back and spoke to one of the counselors, she basically told me that everything is based on a math equation. My number was 72. That was the number of chief of mission personnel. That was the number of people who got out. That was the number of people who were uninjured. That was the number of people who were not assaulted.
Yeah.
She said, any more in that equation, and you could have gone over, and it could have changed everything. Any less in that equation, and you could have gone under, and you could have, and those people could have been hurt.
Yeah.
But she said, but from where I'm sitting, it looks like your math is good. And I think that that's an important nugget to pass on.